it accounted and cheap. Where my time's gone, I can't say. I just can't turn around and walk away.
Welcome to Drupal Easy Podcast number 138. My name is Mike Anello, and I'm flying without a co-host today. Everybody seems to be a bit busy this Monday, we'll say afternoon, but luckily our guest is not too busy to join us. Coming back for a second time, at least, right, Rick?
Yes, this is my second podcast.
Okay, for some reason I thought you were like on the podcast as part of like maybe a Drupal camp or something. But yeah, we last had you on. Well, let me introduce you first, because I know who you are. But Rick Manelius. Rick, you are Director of Operations at New Media, and you're kind of a Drupal PCI compliance guru. So the last time we had you on was podcast 109, which was sometime last year, if I'm correct. And you kind of set the stage for us. We talked about PCI compliance. But since then, some things have changed. So we're going to get everybody updated on that today. So welcome, Rick.
Thank you for having me. Again, this is just an absolute pleasure to be speaking to people again. And I know on the first podcast, people left a little bit in fear, and I think there's still some, you know, PCI compliance can be very difficult, and I understand that. But I think the stuff we have to talk about today is going to help clarify a lot of things for a lot of people.
Yeah, actually, the title of our last podcast with you was Gray Area.
Yes.
Which I think was pretty telling. So maybe this will be a slightly less gray area.
Absolutely. And the gray area, and we'll dive into the details later, but the gray area was, you know, the PCI industry, you know, even though with the 2.0 standard, there was this huge gap between what people had to comply with, and their own documentation didn't really give people a clear understanding of, well, do I go the easy path or the difficult path, and what if I live somewhere in the middle? And as a result of that, it was quite scary because people didn't want to have to deal with all the difficulty of complying with the harder standard, but they couldn't guarantee it, and so that made it very difficult. And so that gray area, I think, is a little bit clearer now.
All right, well, let's start at the basics. For someone who doesn't, you know, we're talking about PCI compliance, and people are thinking, well, what the heck is PCI compliance? Why am I still listening to this podcast?
Yeah, it could be kind of a dry subject, but I thankfully the reception whenever I've given talks at meetups and through podcasts has been very positive, because most people aren't aware of it, even what it is and what it means. So yeah, let's start with the basics, which is PCI compliance basically is a standard that this payment console industry, PCI, sets to make sure that e-commerce is secure, or at least reduce the risk as much as possible. And you know, breaches hurt, like security breaches, and this last year we've just seen a ton of them. I mean, Target, Adobe, you know, PF Chang's, you know, there's Home Depot is now under investigation and so forth. And those data breaches for a site that's transacting e-commerce through credit card and debit card and payment card transactions really hurt a business. I mean, Target lost, I believe, several hundred million dollars in quarter four of 2013 directly as a result of a massive breach that exposed about 40 million of their customer numbers, including myself. I remember getting it in the mail and having several of my cards had to be reissued because we had bought something in that time period. So, you know, when you deal with e-commerce, when you are transacting payments online, it's a great benefit to the website because you now have additional stream of income. But with that comes additional responsibility. And if we don't really take care of that security and really protect payments throughout the end-to-end cycle, you know, we risk having our own breach. And that has both financial and PR liabilities.
So let me interrupt real quick. So
yes,
one thing that people ask me about when I mention PCI compliance is, you know, they ask me, is it the law?
It's not the law as much as it is as a contractual obligation. I mean, you know, and so you're not going to face criminal, you know, penalties unless it was like extremely negligent and you were, you know, basically like
advertising the password
or part of it, you know, and so forth. But you can definitely still be liable for civil penalties, you know, because even if you did your due diligence and you weren't compliant, And by the way, for people who are already panicking, I mean, if you're not running an e-commerce site, this doesn't apply to you. So if you're basically building blogs or publishing platforms and stuff, this doesn't apply. But yeah, if you, yeah.
And that's the second part of what people ask me about is, as the developer, am I responsible, or is, you know, if there is a breach, can the client come after me, or
that is a great question.
The client's problem.
That is a fantastic question and a great segue, because in the new standard, so just like everything on the web, you know, things evolve. You know, we evolve standards. You know, as security gets better, so does people the ability to attack it. And so we're about ready to release a new standard, or the PCI industry is going to 3.0, which goes into effect on January 1st of 2015. And one of the new changes is that exactly, which is you can no longer just assume that the developer or the merchant or the hosting provider takes on pieces of the responsibility. You, in fact, have to have written agreement in terms of who takes on what. And so by default, the developer doesn't necessarily assume that because, you know, unless it's specified in your contract that you have secured the Drupal application and server layers to that extent and you take on that responsibility, the developer isn't. Though I do feel there's an obligation to disclose that to the merchant. So that's a clear line. Like, until you assume it, you didn't take it on. But I think as a best practice, you should.
Right, because that's interesting. Because I have, I'm risk adverse, to say.
Yes.
And I've actually, for quite some time, I've had a clause in all of our agreement, or client agreement, saying that the client assumes all risk and liability for PCI compliance.
And I think that's a great strategy to be proactive about it, because at the very least, that brings up a conversation as opposed to just sort of ignore it and hope they don't ask.
Exactly. All right. So summarizing, so it's a contractual obligation between the organization who wants to process credit cards or wants to, you know, have credit card processing on their website, and the credit and the payment
card industry, yeah, through your merchant bank or the acquirers, basically whoever is going to ultimately receive the credit card transaction and deposit money in your bank, that's what you're signing up as a contract. With a contractual obligation with.
That we're going to make sure it's as it meets the security requirements.
Absolutely. Yep.
And there's various levels, which I'm assuming we're going to get to here in a minute.
Oh, I could talk levels all day long, but we'll keep it brief. So, just to give a little bit more, because if anyone didn't hear the previous podcast or still not very hip to the scene, PCI from like, if we talk about like PCI 101, like, you know, we already talked that it's a contractual obligation. You're going to accept payment transactions. So you fall in this standard. So what does the standard mean? So, you know, the thing is we have to look at this problem as a holistic solution, because if you have the most secure, you know, say server, and, you know, you got all your firewall settings, you got, you know, all your patches, and, you know, you really locked it down. But on the Drupal side, you exposed, you know, the admin password, or gave admin privileges to too many people, or had PHP filter on, or so forth and so on, you know, the security of the information passing through the entire system really is as strong as the weakest link. So in order to understand that and basically help document, well, then how do we secure that entire passage? The payment card industry passed this standard called, you know, the DSS, Digital Data Security Standard, that goes over the 12 areas of responsibility. And within that, they go through all the different controls that you need to meet within each bucket. And so it really is, at the end of the day, a large checklist of controls to meet. And to your question, Mike, the number of controls you need to meet really depends on how you set up your payment transactions. The endpoints are pretty extreme. You know, there are some people that try to store credit cards. And unfortunately, on some Drupal sites, you still see people storing cards, unfortunately. And then the other extreme is, well, what if we outsource this as much as possible? You know, and the typical way to do this, or the one that most people are familiar with, is redirecting over to like a PayPal or somewhere else where the credit card is taken over there. And so where you fall in that gamut really determines how many security controls that you need to meet as a merchant. So that's the most critical part that I want people to come out of this with, is you really, based on how you set up your Drupal site, can largely influence the amount of effort it's going to take you to become compliant. And so that's at a base level, you know, PCI 101. That's what you need to really consider. And a short plug before we dive into the details. This is a very big topic for me and something I'm very passionate about. And something that the Drupal community is really starting to awaken to. I mean, people are asking questions, they're pinging me in IRC or in Twitter, and getting invited to do talks at certain places. And I really feel like we're just starting to get this awareness out to the community. So to really make that more accessible to people, myself and two co-authors and a lot of reviewers put together a white paper at a website called DrupalPCIcompliance.org, where in about an hour you can read sort of an overview of this whole topic in a little bit more detail to be even more informed and more educated.
Right, and that was something I think you had that put together or it was had just launched when we first did the podcast, and I assume it's been updated as things have changed.
It absolutely has, and what we'll go into at some point soon is sort of the new changes, because even if you were very aware of the old standard, the new one has some significant changes that we want to touch on. But at least now we've talked about enough of the overview stuff that everyone should be at least as caught up as you can be.
Exactly. So I guess the what we're going to move into next is, you know, when you're building a site, or maybe you even already have a site, your level of integration with payment is going to be directly proportional to how many controls you have to adhere to or meet in order to be PCI compliant. So let's go from the easiest, which would be level A. To the most difficult, which would be where you're actually storing credit cards on your server.
Yes. the very dangerous SAQD. So the easiest approach, and you know, vendors used to even advertise like you can go PCI compliance in 15 minutes, you know, just use our service, which is totally outsourced, and we'll actually download a pre-filled out SAQA, you know, and you can just sign your name in like 15 minutes, you know. So it wasn't that. I mean, really you should consider it an afternoon, because you've outsourced enough of it where there's about 13 to 15 controls. Largely it's like, you know, do you have a password policy? Do you have a security policy? And you know, you could get through that fairly quickly, and a lot of it is just sort of checkboxes, you know, very, very easy to do.
But what case is this? This is the case where from the client website you're basically saying, click here to pay, and you're being redirected.
So. Yeah, and this is still a point of contention, but it's more clear because the PCI Council did follow up on the 3.0 standard with some clarifications, because there was still a gray area, and that was unfortunate. But where it all seems to land right now, based on the council's SAQs and also their follow-up clarification documents, is that hosted payment pages where you redirect over and come back, meaning you literally go to a PayPal site, you pay, and then it pings it back to your server, and then you basically see your order complete form. That's the hosted payment page. That falls into A technically. And we're still going to recommend, and as we do in the paper, that you follow A-EP, but you can still technically comply with A, which is great. For a lot of merchants, that's huge. And
so
the other one...
Does that include, and I know this is something we talked about last time, but does that include where... that's actually, just a link over to PayPal. So you have to protect against link jacking there.
Basically,
correct?
I mean, there's still... As the council has noted in other documents, you still can do man-in-the-middle attacks. If you can manipulate the DOM and you can change the form action or change that, you still could attack a hosted payment page. That's why there's still some people saying, well, yes, you can comply with A, but you really, really should do A-EP, because if you don't update your Drupal modules, you don't apply your security patches, you don't lock it down, technically you can do that, but the council has basically stated in their FAQs that the level of effort to do that is hard enough and it's detectable early enough, they say, that they still consider it or will allow it to fall into SAQA.
All right, so what's A-EP then? What's the difference?
So A-EP was like a new version, because remember, for anyone that listened to the previous podcast or read the previous version of the paper, there was this huge gap between A, which is you can fill out 15 minutes, you can be done with it, and you can go on with your life, and C, and the two standard, which was you have to lock down all your servers, your firewall settings, you need to be up to date with all your patches, you need to do all these items, and that took months of time for an average merchant to basically get up to code with those types of things.
But forget about the time. Let's just talk about the money.
The money. You know, if you're paying a developer and so forth, I mean, and not only the money, but it limits your options. Because if you, you know, have a small site, you know, a $5,000 budget, and you're trying to, you know, launch on like Dreamhost or GoDaddy or something, you pretty much rule those options out. Because, you know, if you needed to have your server fully locked down with intrusion detection, antivirus, et cetera, you were already having to be at AWS at a minimum and other PCI level one hardware. So it limited your options. It cost a lot of money. And so people were in this sort of, well, but what am I? You know, I'm using Stripe. Where do I fall on that gamut? You know, because I'm technically still vulnerable, but I'm technically not taking cards. So, and so forth. A-EP basically was right in the middle of the two and said, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to put this one, this new SAQ, which is really made for direct post payments. So people that are, so a direct post payment is sort of like hosted payment page, but instead of redirecting to like PayPal, paying there and redirecting back, the form element is changed such that when you hit submit, it sends the data directly to the card processor and then gets a response and then goes through the checkout. So it looks to the user like they've never left the site. But in reality, this credit card data did send over to, say, Stripe or Braintree, and then came back.
Now, that's different, though, than where
it is. Yeah.
The logic is actually on the client server first, where they hit the button and some logic fires off. You know, the form is actually posted back to the same server, and then maybe there's a web service that calls out to the payment processor, right?
Let me try to explain it again, because I think you got it, but I just want to make sure we're on the same page. So on a hosted payment page, on the form element, you click submit and it will redirect you. You literally go to a different domain. You go to like the PayPal or Offnet or so forth. And it's totally, you can usually brand it a little bit, but they control the entire page. You pay and then it'll post back to your site through a URL and a token that basically represents that you did pay. And then that token's passed back to the gateway. So that's hosted payment page. Whereas direct post, literally, like when you hit that submit, that post hit, you know, is sent directly to the processor, and then they get to the return value, and then it goes to the rest of the site. The user never leaves your website, never is redirected or anything. They stay directly on the page. So that's the difference between like a direct post and a hosted payment page.
Okay.
And the issue is, and this is actually quite interesting, because as part of my I did a Drupal camp talk. And the very site, the Drupal camp that I was at, was using Stripe. And unfortunately, I was actually a member of the team that built the site. So I sort of had an in, and I knew the vulnerabilities of the method. Because with a direct post, you could put a keylogger, say, on a payment page. And unlike a man in the middle, like if I change, you know, if I am redirected to a hosted payment page, I still can't have access to the credit card data on the Drupal site itself. But a direct post, if people are still entering their credit card information on the site.
Right.
And so you could, I had an example, and I obviously wasn't collecting live data because that would have been very bad. but, you know, I did a demo where I took a clone of the site and I was able to show, look, I had access to administer blocks and the PHP filter. Therefore, I could drop this in the checkout page and I'm here, I'm recording all the keystrokes here.
Right.
So direct post is much more vulnerable than hosted payment page, because key logging and so forth is now accessible, and anyone with the appropriate permissions, generally a site builder level, could in fact be attacking the payment page itself.
So what's the level of effort to meet SAQ A-EP?
Pretty significant still. I mean, you almost want to consider it as difficult as the previous SAQC. I mean, 138 controls, you know, it'll take you a couple of weeks. If you've never done it before, maybe up to a month or more. And some of it you could still offload. Like if you pick the appropriate hosting and so forth, you could offload as much of those responsibilities as possible. In fact, just picking the right hosting provider could drop 60% of those controls, which is huge. Mm-hmm. But if you want to do it all yourself, then you really need to know what you're doing. So that's why in the paper, we highly encourage hosted payment pages and iframes because they can get you into the A bucket and therefore reduce all that extra work. But the problem is, you know, for people doing recurring billing and so forth, sometimes they need to use a solution like that and they can't get around it. So in that case, a feature or requirement when we force you to use a solution that's in the 8SGP bucket. So it's not always like a, you know, use PayPal and call it a day.
Right. Sometimes the requirements of the site dictate.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
All right. So then what's the next level?
So they've eliminated C, and this is where things get really difficult for people that require a solution or don't have the option to use one of those shared management solutions. So D is essentially as if you are storing credit cards. They basically said, you know, we used to differentiate between C and D. D was storing cards, C was transmitting, but now they just got rid of it completely. And that's about 360 controls. And extremely difficult to deal with. And so, like, for example, in my company, when we do like a security audit for someone, especially if they're doing e-commerce, and we find out they're using a merchant managed solution, which is basically the category of ones that have the card pass through Drupal, we immediately, that's our first recommendation. It's like, let's rip that out. Let's get you to a hosted payment page or something else.
So what's an example of like a merchant managed system? Like, was that using like Drupal Commerce with something like Authorize.net where you're redirected?
Yeah, exactly. So both UberCart and Drupal Commerce, UberCart has it bundled with as one of the default gateways that comes with UberCart. It's a submodule, Authorize.net. And then Drupal Commerce, you can download the default Authorize.net, or Commerce Authorize.net module. And by default, those ones don't. So Authorize.net is pretty interesting that they offer the ability to do direct post and redirects, but the default functionality that most people use is the CIM or ARB, and both of those pass through the server. So basically what that means is customer hits submit, and what happens, that card sends back to the Drupal layer, and then Drupal fires up, Apache fires up, PHP is going, you know, goes to the form API, it does all the validation, and then it sends it off to Authnet. Well, everything in that process, everything from Bootstrap to, you know, watchdog logging and everything else, all those areas are exposed to someone else modifying a module or, you know, putting a form alter in or something where someone could be taking cards without you knowing. So that's why D in a merchant managed solution is that much more difficult to secure, because you have all these different entry points to attack it.
And it's one of those things where the ideal situation from a usability standpoint is to keep the client on our site, surrounded by our branding, make it as seamless as possible. But that ends up being the hardest level of PCI compliance to attain.
And the only caveat to that, and this, you know, people argue this, but and again, the PCI industry for whatever reason put them on the same level. Although people will argue this point, and I'm just putting that little caveat there. Iframe is another approach, and this sort of combines the best of hosted payment page and direct post, because, you know, people complain they don't want to lose their branding, they don't want to lose control, they want to keep someone on their site. But again, direct post or merchant managed, now you're opening up these attack vectors to get the card information. So what an iframe does is it literally is an iframe on a page, and it loads the credit card payment form directly on your site. And because an iframe, by the scope definition of how the browser manages security, JavaScript in the parent DOM, meaning the web page itself, can't reach into the iframe. Mm-hmm. Therefore, things like keylogging are no longer possible. So the only way to attack an iframe is a similar way to attack in the hosted payment page, is you actually have to mess up the link, you know, alter the form action, or in the case of the iframe, you have to literally use JavaScript to replace the form out, or the iframe out.
Yeah, swap it out with a nefarious version.
Exactly, right. To do another man-in-the-middle attack. And again, harder to do, because now you got to set set the infrastructure such that the client or the merchant still gets the payment with the sort of man-in-the-middle attack, so that way, because otherwise customers, if it was a complete replacement and you're just accepting cards, customers would complain immediately, like, hey, I just ordered, and then the merchant would say, but I don't see it appear. So that could be detected very quickly. So that's why the man-in-the-middle attacks get up to A. And so for users that want to sort of keep you on the page and still get the benefit of SAQA in terms of the reduced controls, iframe is the way to go. The unfortunate caveat there is there's not many of those solutions for UberCart or Drupal Commerce.
And I think the other side of that is iframes generally are more difficult to make responsive.
Yes, because you lose control over whatever's in the iframe. And you know, you are basically... And again, you can control everything else around the page, which keeps that whole issue of branding, you know, at least somewhat addressed, but you still don't handle the iframe. There are harder integrations to do, and so forth and so on.
Right. All right. So it seems like, you know, what we need to do as a community is to, you know, ensure people are aware of, you know, when you download and install UberCart or Drupal Commerce, you know, the defaults aren't necessarily the easiest.
And it could be deceptive. Because the defaults may not be the easiest in some cases, and this is
easiest
really
from a PCI compliance standpoint, I should say.
Understood. But one module that we've discovered as part of one of our audits that we did for a client of ours was that there was, and I won't name it because it's not cool, but there's a module out there, and if you search for it, you'll find it, where the service that they use is a direct post service. But the way the module was implemented, they still did it in a merchant managed way. So instead of doing the API call so that the payment information never got touched or never touched the Drupal server, they still modified it such that when they did the API call, it was after they already stored it on the order for a page load and then sent it out. So you could be doing believing you're doing your due diligence by picking an appropriate service like, you know, Authnet versus Braintree versus Stripe. But the very module itself may not actually even be implementing it to the way that the service expects. So for that client, you know, who thought they did a great job picking the appropriate module, actually still had as much of a security risk as any other merchant managed solution, which was unfortunate.
All right, so let's break this down a little bit more.
Yes.
Let's say, you know, one of our listeners is creating a new e-commerce site, and they want to figure out, like, what should I charge depending on what type of payment mechanism I'm going to put in. Mm-hmm. So if they do like a hosted payment page, you know, fairly easy to implement, but that's still going to require, give me a rough number of hours in order for them or the client to meet SAQA.
I think SAQA is one of those you can meet it in the afternoon. It's about 4 hours. You could, you know, by the time it takes you to read it, really understand it, you know, draft up your security policy if you don't already have one, and so forth. And again, it'd be a very light policy, but it'd be a policy nonetheless.
Right.
Say 4 hours, you could probably get away with that.
Okay, and that would be useful, you know, if they're using, you know, going to PayPal for payment or any one of these other sites that offers a hosted payment page.
Yes, correct.
All right, so then if we go up to the next level, that is SAQA-EP, which is direct post, which keeps the, you know, appears to keep the client or the user on the site the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference in level of effort going from an afternoon to, you said, possibly a month, correct?
I would say if you know what you're doing, if you do this a lot, if you're an agency or you're a contractor and you do this all day long, you're probably going to be, you know, days to week, a week. But if this is your first time doing it and you really have to go through that document and really get these procedures in place, your own deployment processes, your own coding standards, I would easily say a month could be doable.
And then would you recommend that those people who haven't done it before hire someone to help them, or what's the most common way of doing this?
Yeah, I would definitely reach out. There are some companies that specifically do PCI compliance work. You know, and again, if you are doing the transaction volume and your features require you to use a solution that gets you an A-EP, mm-hmm. I would absolutely reach out because it's just a comfort thing. It's a confidence thing. You know, you'll get a lot further down the road and bang for your buck. I did it my first time all by myself, and then I paid for it in hours. You know, it took me many months to sort of get to SAQC, and now I can do it much faster. So, I mean, it's wherever you want to spend your time or money, and I think you can definitely accelerate it by reaching out to an appropriate resource.
And then for merchant managed, you know, obviously, if you haven't done that before,
Don't do it. Yeah, I mean, really don't do it.
And that's
the scary
one, because that's kind of the whiz bang feature. If you download Drupal Commerce and install a payment module, it's all right there. And
the scary part is, and again, I cut my teeth many years on the UberCart and I've moved over to Drupal Commerce, and I sort of they both have their pros and cons. The issue is there are some times where you just can't get away from it, like recurring billing, for example, with Authorize.net CIM. You know, if you use Authorize.net's hosted payment version, you can't store the customer information on that on their site and or on their in their service, and then use that token to do your recurring charges from Drupal side. So if you're doing a membership based site or recurring billing, and you're on UberCart and you choose the Authorize.net version with CIM, you pretty much have to be using Merchant Manage, and there's really no way around it. And unfortunately, Authorize.net is still a very popular service, but again, we're just not there yet. And the beauty is, or I guess the one benefit though of Authorize.net is they do offer a hosted iframe solution, you know, the iframe version. Mm-hmm. But no one in the community, you know, because it's always that first mover, who's going to do it? No one's built that one out yet. So it's like we could, in fact, as a community, have a very secure iframe solution for UberCart that would even work with recurring billing. We just don't have it yet as a contrib module.
I mean, it seems to me that as a community, we need to, and maybe not as an entire community, but the Drupal Commerce community or even the UberCart community, the kind of the default payment mechanisms or even the recommended payment mechanisms should be these, you know, SAQA hosted payment page options.
Yes, and absolutely.
It should be, I don't know, maybe not more difficult, but at least make people aware that, hey, you're now implementing a merchant managed solution.
Yes.
You know, it's going to take you approximately X hours, you know, to meet PC clients and hear some stuff you want to read about. It seems like our default should be the easiest.
Absolutely. And the reality is, even when people are made aware of it, the unfortunate reality is some people, you know, I can't pay for that, so I'm just not going to do it. And you know, it's, you can technically do that. I mean, you can ignore the whole policy and just move on with your life. But
and
you
hope that nothing happens.
And hope that nothing happens. And, you know, for a large amount of people, nothing does happen. And right. But when it does, man, does it hurt.
That could, you know, be the end of that could be the end of your business.
It could be the end, because here's the deal. The PCI industry has basically a one-strike rule, which is if you have a reported breach, meaning, you know, they could trace back, you know, four or five cards were stolen and you were the common source, and so they were able to trace it back to you, you pretty much now require an external audit at that point. Mm-hmm. So you can't just say, oh, I'll take care of it myself. You know, you lost that option. And you know, an external audit itself could put you on, you know, 10 to 30 grand, you know, to purchase the services and consultation of an appropriate QSA. So it could very well put you out of business. Now, for some people that are only transacting one or two things a month, their e-commerce thing was just sort of like a nice feature add. But if it's your primary source of revenue, if your business is based around your site, mm-hmm. and that's your primary thing, that could kill your business, really.
Right, right.
So
how about, I just lost my thought there for a second.
Sure.
What was I going to say?
We're going to ask about the cost of D again. Don't do it.
No, I'm not going to. No, I wasn't going to ask about that. All right, well, let's move on and maybe I'll remember. So at this point, I mean, we talked about this last time on the podcast, is to me, this really seems like an opportunity for people in the community who have, and it's, you know, it's people like you, Rick, who have knowledge about Drupal and knowledge about PCI compliance. It seems like there's a niche there to be a Drupal / PCI compliant consultant.
Yeah, actually, and you brought that up on your podcast with Moshe. You know, it's like, you know, people have been, you know, made niches in migrations or niches in, you know, e-commerce or niches in, you know, publishing or so forth and so on. And you know, the hardest part is really convincing people that this is a good thing to do. Like, a lot of people, the first question is, well, how do I make money from it? It's like, that's not necessarily your first question.
How do you save money from it?
How do you save money from doing it? And how do you save your client? And how do you do it as a value add? You know, I've worked with a couple companies that are, you know, sort of as a consultant that were, you know, asking, well, how do I charge for this? Well, it's just like anything. You know, do you do a security audit? Do you do a performance audit? You know, do you do a PCI compliance audit? You know, it's an upsell. And it's actually been a differentiator, even for, you know, again, back with my company, the fact that we have someone in-house like myself that understands this, not only as a comfort factor for the client, but it's actually helping us win business, because we can differentiate ourselves against a competitor, because they may not know the first thing to do about this. Even if they read the white paper, they still may not have the confidence or the expertise on how to then provide an appropriate recommendation, and us being able to do that has really even helped us win business. So it's not, you can sell it as an extra line item on a contract. You could just have it as part of, this is how we do things. You know, this is now part of our end-to-end system, and just who we are, and then we can differentiate ourselves as a result of it.
So I remembered what my question was. So, you know, good. When I have clients and they're talking to potential payment card processors, mm-hmm. it's not really in the payment card processor's interest to explain PCI compliance all that much, because it raises the, you know, it puts more hurdles in front of them closing the sale, so to speak.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's generally, at least for, especially for small merchants, you know, ones that are transacting less than 20,000 transactions in a year, that's typically like a level four merchant. Yeah, it's usually not something you want to beat over the head because they don't want you to scare you away. I mean, if your first introduction with sales is, hey, by the way, you're about ready to embark on this huge security thing, you know, most people just run away. But if you, the fine print, and right. You know, they don't necessarily want it to scare you away. And so, no, they're not going to put this to the forefront of the conversation.
So I know last time we talked about like stats a little bit,
and yes,
as far as, you know, what percentage of sites out there, Drupal or not, or e-commerce sites out there are PCI compliant. And I think we didn't have any hard numbers at the time, but I think you had seen some anecdotal stuff where you were saying maybe 5 to 10%.
Yeah, and that was based on a sort of a gut decision, just because in order to become compliant, you need to at least be aware of it. You assume like, and the beauty is, and here's the benefit of this work that I've been doing. It's been really rewarding because and giving talks in front of either as meetups or podcasts and so forth. You know, I even meet other members of the security team. I mean, the security team is fairly large, like 40 or 50 individuals when all is said and done. And we don't necessarily always meet at all the different, you know, Drupal cons and so forth. And I've had, you know, people of the security team in the audience and asking great questions and like, I didn't even know about this. So it's amazing that even people who are very security minded aren't even aware that the standard exists or the implications of it. But once they do, they really seem to grab onto it and sort of become advocates for it. I've seen people ask questions again on Twitter and so forth, and I've seen other people jump in and answer that. And that's huge to me because it's not just one person just trying to like run this or spearhead this. But I think enough awareness is starting to happen, which was my first objective, is just getting this out there. I don't know how much of it's trickled down to actual implementation, but I am seeing and seeing evidence and hearing stories of people now doing this. And as a result of it, picking better gateways. So I know they're getting closer to compliance. Whether it's above 5 or 10%, I don't know. But at least the awareness part is getting much higher.
Well, it seems like it should be at the same thought level as keeping your Drupal core up to date, keeping your, you know, yes, Apache web server up to date, you know, keeping your operating system of your server operating system up to date and all security patches. It seems like this should just be another kind of line item in your overall security, yeah, of the site.
Exactly. And that's the whole, I mean, to use a different, you know, catchphrase or label that's being thrown about there, is that the sort of DevOps mindset. It's just like, as you get better at doing stuff, it just becomes a standard part of your practice. Like as you learn features and now you always use features because you can lock stuff in code, or, you know, you have a deployment checklist. So every time your client's product is about to ship, you go through a certain number of things, you get the appropriate caching on, you know, you turn on, you know, make sure all the development modules are off. You know, eventually you just become good at it and it just becomes a part of what you do. And it doesn't become like this whole other thing that I have to learn and add to my system. So ideally, you know, people that are working on bigger sites, because Drupal is getting more enterprise, we're getting more larger sites out there. So performance and security are sort of becoming sort of standard and required in a lot of projects. And I feel like if you have an e-commerce site or an e-commerce consultant agency, this is going to eventually become a standard part of your practice.
So it sounds like for smaller companies, you know, if you're not using a hosted payment page, you should probably do that.
Yes.
And don't be afraid of SAQA.
Yes. And right. I would also recommend to at least be aware of the SAQA-EP. Read it once. You know, okay, at the very minimum, read it once. So even if you're not required to implement them, you know, it's highly recommended you implement as much of it you can. Some of it's just good common sense. Some of it's just best practices and so forth. Some of it's going to scare some people, you know, like, you know, two-factor authentication should be out of the box, you know. So, you know, if you have YubiKey or any other of the TFA module vendors and so forth, I mean, that's huge. You should be doing that. You should, every admin user to the site should have their own username and login, you know. So there are some things that may not be part of your practice, but maybe having read A-EP, maybe they become part of your practice. It's just good security best practices.
All right. Very good. And then for people who are currently have, you know, either have developed an e-commerce site or, you know, if they own an e-commerce site that is using that merchant managed authorize.net kind of, you know, suck the credit card information into Drupal, even if you're not storing it, if it's going out via a curl or some type of a secure post somewhere, that's still going to put you in that SAQD for dangerous. And that's the one, that's the one that you really recommend people get out of unless they really know what they're doing and have a financial interest to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. And some people just can't. And here's, you know, I've actually contacted a colleague recently because they have this great service. You know, they're selling a subscription to, you know, basically educational materials. And, you know, I noticed, I was like, hey, I see you're using UberCart. I see you're using what appears to be a merchant managed solution. You know, you really need to consider this. And his reply was exactly what most people will respond with, which is, yeah, but the cost of me having all my customers switch my payment gateway and have to have them re-enter their cards with a different solution like Recurly, for example, is going to be a huge change. And it's going to require, I'm going to lose some customers. And so my answer is that is absolutely. And I understand and appreciate that concern. But the alternative is you're either going to spend the time in that conversion or you're going to spend the time locking it down, or you just stay at risk in the middle ground. Right. So I totally understand that, you know, things that have already been built could take a long time. It's not just swapping it out for some people. Some people it is because they're just one-off transactions and I could switch a payment gateway tomorrow and be done with it.
Right.
But some people are already really invested in the particular solution they've already picked, and it's a hard changeover cost for them. So,
well, yeah. And the way I've actually approached it with one or two clients is, and I've literally pulled this number out of the Gamma Quadrant, is I've said, you know, we can go with authorize.net and have it fully integrated on your site, but is that worth $10,000 to you?
Exactly. You know, some people are like, I need to brand it in my way. It's like, well, is it worth this much time, effort, and so forth? Oh, probably not. Then you've already put it on the table and you did it proactively. Right. You didn't get through all your mock-ups, your design comps, and your scope, only to spring this up at the end, and then it becomes a contentious point. You bring it up in the very beginning and say, you know, you have choice A or B. You know, you could fully host it, brand it, et cetera. But this is the implications, or you can do this other one, and then you'd be surprised. Most clients, when you they may not like it, but when they realize attach a dollar figure to it, it becomes a much easier conversation.
Yeah, I can't imagine there's that many, you know. Well, relatively speaking, the percentage of companies that actually need it to be merchant managed and never have anybody leave their site, or as you're saying, with the recurring payments, that's got to be such a small fraction of the overall e-commerce sites out there.
And just to sort of close that loop, I mean, we have a client ourselves that still need to do recurring billing in Drupal Commerce. And what we had to use is hosted PCI, which had off-net CIM as a backend. And by doing that, we had an iframe solution, so falling in SAQA bucket, but still allowed recurring payments. So we were able to achieve it, but you have to use their service. And for some people, you know, either they don't want to use it because their fees are different or because there's a, you know, an initial cost to set it up. So, you know, with hosted PCI, I really love that service. I recommend it all the time, but you also have to have a certain transaction volume before they all consider you, because they're basically offloading a lot of the responsibility. And like, if you're only doing two transactions a month, you know, you're not, you know, again, so you're limited sometimes by the options, the payment gateways that you could even use. But if you could justify it, use that type of solution, and you can get out the both the branding and the recurring billing on the same site.
All right, let me ask you one more question, because this just popped into my head. This is for it's not even one of my clients. It's like a family friend that I helped set up their site years ago.
Don't we all start Drupal that way? They have a family friend that had a problem.
But they take online payments, but the way, and I don't want to mention who their processor is or anything, but the way it was set up, this is, you know, probably 4 years ago or so when we set this up, was the payment processor provided us with an HTML form that posted back to their server. So it sounds like direct post to me, but the information in the form was only the amount to pay and like the store identifier.
Right.
No credit card information. So you basically, the user went to the page, said, I got a bill for $400. So they type 400 into a box, hit a button, and then they're redirected to a hosted payment page.
Right. So that's basically a hosted payment page.
Okay. That's what I figured.
Because the card data itself is being inserted to the hosted payment page.
Right. And that's what matters. Yeah. That's the point I was trying to make. What matters is, the card data? What server is that hitting?
Yeah. And this is where I got to always finish the podcast by saying, I'm not a qualified QSA, blah, blah, blah. Do your own research. But yeah, from just what you told me, absolutely.
Sounds like SAQA.
Yeah. SAQ, A-EP, because it's direct post.
Well, is A-
No, you're right. Sorry. Host a payment page, because it is posting, but it is technically redirecting the card data there. So
right,
host a payment page.
Yeah, the card data never hits the...
Exactly. And it is entered directly on a page loaded by your processor. So that would make it host a payment page. Yes.
I guess the other thing we should bring up here real quick is when you are using an iframe solution, you know, the iframe obviously has to come from a secure server.
Yes.
And even though the credit card information isn't being input on your server should still be secure. Actually, these days, all servers should be secure. I mean, that's a whole other.
Yeah, I mean, again, that's, you know, you can say from a technical perspective, you could say, well, it doesn't have to be because, you know, you have to replace the iframe and then it goes back to the man in the middle attack, blah, blah, blah.
But in order to get the lock icon on your browser, doesn't the whole thing have to be secure?
You should definitely put, you should definitely put it under HTTP SSL.
Right.
But technically, the iframe, its post itself would already have an HTTPS in it, so it's definitely, you know, it's going to send there. But from a, you know, just a client satisfaction and security, and just feeling the warm and fuzzies of seeing the lock, you should definitely still have the SSL on a server using iframe or host a payment page for that matter.
Exactly. All right. So did we get everybody up to speed?
I think we did. There's always going to be ongoing conversations, but you know, people can. At the Drupal PCI compliance, which is posted off of GitHub, if there's other issues with the paper and other questions, they can start posting stuff there and we can continue the conversation.
No, but I like this because we basically told people stop, you know, with the merchant managed stuff.
Stop using merchant managed.
Unless you've got a ginormous budget.
And unless it makes sense, you have a budget and you have a reasonable justification for doing it. Yes.
Yep. And even, I mean, it seems like, you know, the difference between direct post and the hosted payment page, there's enough of a difference in meeting all the controls, and you're not, I mean, you're getting a little bit of usability, you know, with a direct post, but are you getting, I think you said a week's to a month's worth of time and money by using direct post as.
And the answer is usually not, no.
So everybody should just use a hosted payment page.
They should if they can, but sometimes some features don't allow that yet. Right. And I think what we're seeing now is just like security is evolving and just like, you know, hackers' sophistication on attacking them has increased, we're also seeing a lot of new features and a lot of new changes to both the payment providers and then the modules that exist for the community. And I think one of the things that I would like to see is just more solutions offered for both the UberCart and Drupal Commerce community that solve these and provide these iframe and hosted payment page and, you know, even more secure direct post methods and just try to eliminate the need to use any merchant managed solutions at all.
Yeah, let me, you know, I'm going to rephrase what you just said. I'm going to say that Rick is now calling out.
Oh, boy.
The UberCart and Commerce communities, or maintainers, developer, you know, those whole sub-Drupal communities, let's have more realistic default payment methods. Yeah, and let's make it obvious when someone is choosing something that could be difficult to attain from a PCI standpoint.
Yes.
That way, people who aren't necessarily, you know, listening to the podcast or aware of PCI compliance, they should be, every time they're enabling a PCI, I mean, here's something that, you know, food for thought, you know, maybe there should be some type of API for payment modules, that every payment module has to declare, you know, if you use this payment module configured this way, your, you know, SAQA. If you do it this way, it's SAQEP or A-EP, and with links to what all that stuff means.
That's a great suggestion. In fact, Michael Hess, the head of the security team, is and I have been sort of working together. We have a list of every UberCart and Commerce payment module, and now we have this sort of the laborious task of reviewing all of them.
Yeah.
But the goal is, to have like a document or a page in Drupal.org that says, look, here are all the payment solutions and here's what they're compatible with. This one's compatible with, you know, D. This one's compatible with A-EP.
But rather than you guys doing that work, that should be pushed down to the module maintainers.
Yeah, we've had a debate about this, you know, about whether we sort of require that. And I think, you know, it's one of those you catch more, you know, with honey than vinegar. And I think what happens is if we mandate that, it sort of sets a bad precedent, even though it's important.
All right, let me tell you how we're going to get this done. Okay. What we're going to do is we're going to go right to, you know, forget about the module maintainers then.
Yeah.
Okay. You're not going to be the bad guy. We're going to make someone else the bad guy.
Oh, is this Ted? Or
I'm thinking Ryan's Rama should be the bad guy. Because everybody loves that guy right now.
No one's going to be mad at Ryan, right?
No one's going to be mad at him. So let's have him. I'm calling Ryan out. Fantastic. Wouldn't it be great if, in order for a payment module to even be activated or, you know, usable in Drupal Commerce, if there was a certain, you know, declaration that had to be made saying, under this configuration, you're A-EP. Let's make Ryan the bad guy.
You know, great suggestion, and I'm good.
Sounds like you're fully behind it. That's great.
No, I'm fully behind it, and Ryan is going to give me an email, and I'm not going to hear the end of it.
Ryan's the greatest guy ever. He can take the hit.
He can take the hit, but he already gets so many emails, and if he gets people jumping in on this, he's going to be really mad at me. So I'm going to step back. But here's a possibility, and it's, again, something that we've talked a lot with Greg Madison and Michael Hess, which is, you know, as a security team, you know, we don't review or we don't do security advisories if there's not like a stable release. That's one of the criteria. You know, so if something's an RC1 or beta or so forth, issues can be discussed publicly. Mm-hmm. And there was at least a debate about, well, I mean, for a module that is transacting cards, I mean, do we have to have a requirement where they have to put a 2-sentence, this is compatible with A or A-EP or D, and do we require that? And I mean, to go live or to be considered a 1.0 or above. And I mean, it's a valid thing. And if it could be embraced by the module maintainers, I think that would be great. And I think that's the first strategy we're going to try, is we're going to try to see how much is embraced versus how much they fight us on it. And if they, right, if they do it without sort of making it a requirement, I think that's the better approach. But also for protecting people's interests, I mean, we're still going to have to at some point disclose it and have it either on the module page itself or some page, some on Drupal.org that says, hey, here's the lowdown on all the modules for accepting payments. Here's what SAQ you should be reading if you're going to use this one. And at that point, at least people can be informed, which is important.
Right. So I'll let Ryan off the hook now as well. But, you know, maybe it's not, like you said, a requirement, but it would be great if there was something in Drupal Commerce that when you declared a payment mechanism, you could also optionally declare what level it was. What level it's compatible with.
I think that would be great. And if I get feedback from other people that are on board of that, you know, so hit me on email or hit me on IRC, I'd love to hear.
Right. All right. Well, great. So let's, until the next big change in PCI compliance comes out, or until, you know, something happens in the community like we're talking about right now, where there is some type of way to classify these modules, let's put the PCI discussion not to bed, but let's move on, at least.
Put it on pause.
Put it on pause for now.
Yes.
So real quick, a bit of Drupal Easy news before we get to our three stories. Drupal Easy Live online training, our long form, the online version of the Drupal Career Starter Program, which we call the Drupal Career Online, has begun. We started week one last week. So obviously, that makes this week two. It's a 12-week long program. We meet three times a week. There is a dedicated website with screencasts and assessment quizzes and all kinds of documentation and handouts for the students. It's a great way for people who are developers and new to Drupal or just new to content management systems to get up to speed to Drupal in a minimum amount of time. We do class projects. The first thing we did last week during, we have two classes and one set of lab hours every week. During lab hours, the first thing we always do is we get all of our students onto IRC. So we teach them how to interact with the community right from the very beginning. So this is 12 weeks long. So we will be having another class sometime next year. I think we're figuring out the dates right now. But definitely keep an eye out for these people. If you're interested in hosting one of these students in an internship, they will be ready sometime in mid-November. So you can contact me for that. And I want to thank Chris Shattuck over at Build a Module, who every year he generously donates free subscriptions to buildamodule.com for all of our students for the time period that they're in our class. So always very generous of Chris and buildamodule.com. Other thing I wanted to mention is we do have our ongoing series of live online public workshops. These are generally 8-hour workshops. We split them up over 2 days, 2 4-hour sessions. And we've partnered up with both Blink Reaction and Acquia. We are training partners of both. So you can find out when our classes are by going to Drupal Easy or Blink Reaction or training.acquia.com. And then as always, if you subscribe to the Drupal Easy newsletter, you can get a notification of upcoming classes as well as coupon codes for a discount off of those registration fees. All right, so our first story, it's almost a segue. I almost broke into this story a little earlier, Rick, when you mentioned two-factor authentication. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you know about this being on the security team, so this is fortuitous to have you here. But there's actually a two-factor authentication test for Drupal.org. Greg Knadison posted about it, and it's currently open right now where people can go and try and hack it. So are you familiar with this? Is this something that you've worked on? Or
I'm familiar with it. I haven't worked on it. I know Greg and Ben are really big advocates for this, and there's even a bounty on trying to exploit this. And it's super important. I mean, just like everyone is moving towards two-factor authentication across all their services, their GitHub accounts, their Drupal, eventually their Drupal accounts and everything. Because, I mean, just think of the business loss of having someone attack or have access to your credentials on any large site. I mean, it could be very detrimental and have access to even repos on Drupal.org and so forth. So I'm really excited to see this as a feature that we're going to roll out with soon.
So is this going to work similar to the way, I have it turned on for Google and Apple and some other sites where every time I log in, I get a text message with a code, or how will this work for Drupal.org?
I think that we're still, or not we, because I'm not as active involved as Ben and Greg on this, but I think that the goal is to evaluate, we're still in the process of evaluating the different services because, one example was, what if people in certain demographics don't really have access to a smartphone? We want to make sure that there are people that, have some other means of either the SMS approach, or is it a token that appears through an application on their smartphone, or, there's other command line and other solutions that can generate that one-time token. Right. So once they find one that's both appealing and, doesn't require either a fee or and doesn't exclude anyone out from an accessibility or an access perspective, there'll probably be a couple of ones that you can use. And then, yes, you'll log into the site and then it'll say, okay, please enter your one-time password, your six-digit or whatever the code it is, and then you're back into Drupal.org.
So the site that's up right now that where there's a bounty, that's only for kind of the Drupal side to see if anybody can hack the current two-factor authentication module that's installed.
Yeah, I believe it's a full clone or at least a partial clone of the site. Obviously, I don't want to do this on the live server.
Yeah.
But the goal is, before we roll this out, really wanting to stress test this as best as possible. And that's why the offering of even a bounty on it is to really both inspire people to do it and then also to disclose it, because if we can get that taken care of, that would be amazing and get that rolled out for everyone.
Yeah, I don't think Greg mentioned a time frame in his blog post as far as getting this rolled out to Drupal.org. Are you aware of any hopeful time frame or anything like that?
No, I'm not aware of the exact time frame. I know. Okay. I think they wanted to just leave it long enough, again, and not just to test the actual attacks itself, but also to have the appropriate documentation and tutorials lined up, so when people are ready to do this, they have access to an appropriate resource to review.
Right. I think the bounty right now is through, I want to say September 15th. I'm looking at the site right now, which only puts us at about another week.
Yeah. But this is great. I mean, this is another example of, really individuals investing in a module that the community now has access to. I mean, Ben's been working on the TFA module for, years now, and I know they introduced it at Acquia on their network. And by doing this, not only is it benefiting Drupal.org, but it's trickling down to anyone else that wants to start using this for their Drupal sites, particularly e-commerce.
Yeah, yeah. It's great. I'm not aware of any, but I don't follow too many other CMS open source CMS communities that closely. Are you aware of other communities that have two-factor authentication already in place?
I'm also sort of blinders on. Unfortunately, I haven't left the island.
Yeah, we
too
are.
Much.
we have brick houses on the island.
Exactly.
All right, very good. Next story, Drupal Core update for September 4th. This is one of those things we do every few podcasts where we kind of check out what's happening with Drupal 8. And every other week or so, there's normally a blog post. I think it's supposed to be every week, but for some reason, I seem to see them only about every other week. One of the core Drupal 8 members writes a blog post about where we are, where we're going, what our status is. So we like to share that with everybody. So this one was posted about a week ago by Gabor, and he notes that there's only one beta blocker left, which is amazing. So, and I'll read directly from what he wrote. He said, once we are down to no beta blockers left, a final alpha release will be published. If there are no more beta blockers identified during a two-week window, the first beta release is published. Then, after that, we'll focus on resolving the 100 or so remaining critical issues to get to release candidates. So that sounds like if we can get this this last beta blocker resolved 2 weeks later, we could potentially have a beta. So I would say at the latest, this beta blocker is probably going to be resolved during the 9 days of sprints around DrupalCon Amsterdam.
Agreed, and that would be huge. I know a lot of people, including myself, really were waiting for beta to start. I've already been diving into the Drupal 8 material, but really looking to contribute once things had stabilized out enough where I didn't need to be like a core developer. So this could be a huge sort of jolt to the community to start diving in and looking at those critical issues.
Yeah, I think even at the latest, we would be saying, you know, by Halloween, we should have a beta, you know, worst case, we should have a beta in our hands by Halloween.
Oh, I would think so. And they've done a fantastic job. I know for someone who really is more on the sidelines watching, you know, Gabor and a bunch of others have done a really nice job of splitting up the hard betas into sort of sub-tickets and subtasks. And that has really accelerated the ability to sort of review and get them out in chunks. And I think that's like the last 5 to 7 beta blockers really went through much quicker as a result of that process.
Yeah, now I'm a lot more involved in Drupal 8 than core development than I was for previous versions of Drupal, and seeing, you know, the difference between someone having to review a 100K patch versus a 10K patch, that could be the difference between that patch getting in a few days or a few weeks.
Absolutely. And that's just the mental RAM it takes to get that entire patch in your brain and reviewing it all line by line and all the disparate parts. Absolutely. The smaller and more targeted, the better.
Right. And then the other number, which is always fun to look at, which Gabor notes, is number of critical issues. And I always, rather than looking at the absolute number, I look at how many have been opened in the past time period as opposed to how many have been closed in the time period. And we're at the point now where, you know, around DrupalCon, where were we? Austin? Yeah, DrupalCon Austin. We may have been solving 10 critical issues a week, but we were opening up 15. So we had a net positive. During the last week, again, quoting from Gabor's blog post, we fixed 8 critical issues and 12 major issues and opened 4 criticals and 7 majors. So we're actually gaining ground again. And that puts us at overall 104 release blocking critical issues and 644 major issues, which 644 seems like a huge number, but I think what will happen is a good number of those will have to be solved, but I have a feeling a bunch of those will probably be deferred to 8.1 or 8.2, or maybe if we fix one, we solve 3 type of thing. So I think the number we should be focusing on right now is probably the critical issues, the number of critical issues. Okay, and so the last story, kind of a fun one. I'm a big fan of the Drupal community on Reddit. In the past year or so, it's really come a long way. Some really good content down there, in addition to all the AMAs from people in the Drupal community. There seems to be a lot more feedback to questions or to comments. So, you know, and I'm guilty, but I'm a little bit of a sucker for link bait on Reddit. So this one caught my eye. It was a question that someone posted: how does Drupal persist with being so horrible to use? So I saw that one come through on Reddit. I'm like, well, I have to click that one. I mean, how can I not? And just as a summary, I'm not going to read the entire original post, but I'll read a few sentences here, quoting, "It was always such a huge battle to make Drupal user-friendly, such a huge battle just for me to work out where the hell I was supposed to be defining X or tweaking Y. And then when it comes to editing content, the thing a CMS should be excellent at, Drupal is horrendous. And then he goes on for a few sentences talking about mainly about WYSIWYG and the lack of a WYSIWYG editor out of the box. And this is where his argument kind of breaks down, because obviously in Drupal 7, you have to set up your own WYSIWYG editor. And he's kind of complaining about, or she, I don't know if it's a he or she, I should say the poster, is complaining about the configuration, how difficult it is to do things with WYSIWYG. And I thought one of these replies was kind of interesting. I'm going to skip one of them I was going to mention, but I will mention one of them. It says, I'll bite. You seem to have a fixation on WYSIWYG editors, and you're not alone in this. And then this person goes on to say, let me tell you, on every D8 site that I build in the future, I'm going to be disabling that thing. We'll say.
I think you should say the word, actually.
Yeah, well, it's very cheesy.
There you go. You know?
And he actually goes on, or she, again, the poster, I'm not sure the gender, but actually goes on to say something that I actually completely agree with, is a lot of times WYSIWYG is the wrong solution. And he says it in a way, or she says it in a way that I find very humorous. It's the quickest way to get sites with purple italicized and underlined 36-point Times New Roman text on a site that otherwise uses Verdana. And obviously that's an extreme case. But we've had, we talked to Jeff Eaton about this a few podcasts ago, probably more than a few podcasts ago, but about the fact that when you allow these WYSIWYG editors onto your site, you're really opening the door to have inconsistent markup on your site. Anyway, it's a fun little Reddit thread. I was amused for a good 20 minutes one night. I think it was over the weekend I was reading it. It's all stuff we've probably heard before, but it's coming at the kind of structured content discussion from the angle of Drupal sucks. So I kind of like that, and I was amused by that.
I think Greg always had the best response. Patch is welcome, period.
Exactly. Yeah. All right, so I think we're going to start wrapping things up here because, let me talk about Web-Enabled real quick. Longtime sponsors of our podcast. You can check them out at webenabled.com, and definitely check out Web-Enabled Beta at my.webenabled.com. I was just using their site this morning. We have one of our clients' sites, their dev sites is on there. We use them for our Git hosting, our Git repository hosting, and I was getting a new developer up and running on one of our sites, and I was on there adding him to the team and giving him read-write access to the repository and doing all that good stuff, which, I think in the matter of about 10 minutes, I had everything I needed for this developer to kind of get their site cloned and start contributing to our effort. So if you are either a lone wolf or part of a big organization that needs a hosted Git repository and a dev site that everybody can access, you definitely want to check out webenabled.com. All right, picks of the week. Mine's nice and simple. I'm a big fan of lorem ipsum generators. Actually, right now on my toolbar, as I look at my browser, my default is bacon ipsum. If anyone's used that one before, I used to have veggie ipsum, but I've been in a junk food mode lately, so now we're at veggie ipsum. Now we're at bacon ipsum. I was working with a client a few weeks ago, and they turned me on to hipster ipsum. So if you're into hipsters or teasing hipsters, or you are a hipster, you definitely want to check it out at hipsum.com. I use these lorem ipsum generators whenever I'm teaching or whenever I'm working on a client site and just need some dummy content. It's just something fun you can do that isn't, completely illegible. It basically just fills in your text with hipster style words, or in the bacon ipsum example, words describing different types of meat. Just kind of a fun thing to do. So check that one out at hipsum.co. And Rick, the encrypt module, tell me about that.
Yeah, this is actually, this module's been around for a while, but it's really getting a lot of traction, specifically from both Greg Knadison and also some folks at Thomson Security. It's a module that basically allows you to encrypt and decrypt variables on the fly. So it could be like system variables. And they're also working on ways to basically make certain fields encrypted. So if you had sensitive information, such as social security numbers or any other piece of data that you want to encrypt, it's more of like an API to allow those and allow other services to plug into it, which is pretty awesome because, again, both from the e-commerce perspective, HIPAA compliance, and everything else, you know, databases get passed around sometimes too easily among developers, and having some of the more sensitive data encrypted out of the box is very valuable.
So how does this compare with, I've used the AES module.
I think the benefit of this one is it's more pluggable.
Okay.
Again, so if you wanted to specify either like a default core one like AES or use a third-party service that could basically store that those keys remotely, you could plug those in as well. And I believe it even is more compatible with like the fields or API. So it's not just like you put it in a particular function and then call it directly and have those functions. I think it offers a little bit more integration here. I haven't done a full deep dive on it yet. I still need to test it more. But what I'm seeing in the issue queues is very encouraging.
Okay, yeah, it seems like it's, I'm just looking at the project page now, it seems like it's pretty dead simple to use. There's an encrypt function and a decrypt function.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, it will have performance penalties, and like, you know, sure. With views and stuff, you know, if you do scramble a particular feed's values or field's values, you'll no longer be able to run queries off of it. But as long as you architect it such that it's the fields that you're encrypting are not things that you need to search a key off of, you can still encrypt them, and that's huge.
Right. Okay. Fantastic. I think we use this with one of the Drupal Commerce, I think probably Commerce UPS module, where we actually store the UPS credentials in the variable table, but we encrypt them using the AES module.
That's a great use case. Any like API keys and all those things that when you're passing on a database between people, you want to make sure it's not exposed. Perfect.
There you go. All right, very good. Some upcoming events. You guys have started planning for Drupal Camp Colorado, correct? That's not till next year, though, I believe.
Yeah, we just finished one. And, you know, just like every camp, I think people always want to feel like they're more prepared and things still get done last minute. So to fix that, I mean, we're starting almost a week or starting a month after. So we're already starting our planning for next year's.
All right. Well, we won't pimp that one yet. I will talk about some Blink Reaction training at DrupalCon Amsterdam on Monday, September 29th, a little less than a month from now. This is our introduction to Symfony 2, getting ready for Drupal 8 training. If you are going to Amsterdam, definitely check out this full day of training. I believe the cost is currently 400 euros. Takes place on the day before DrupalCon starts, which I believe is Monday. Yeah, actually, I just said it. Monday, September 29th. Also, a couple of Southeast United States camps this weekend in Chattanooga will be Drupal Camp Chattanooga. The beautiful city, a great place to visit. So check that out if you are in driving distance. And then about a month from now, I will be at, and I'm going to assume that Andrew will be there as well, at Drupal Camp Atlanta, which takes place October 3rd and 4th of the year 2014, obviously. So check out those three events coming up. Rick, where can people find you on Twitter or on the internet? I just gave it away. Damn.
On the interwebs.
Yes.
The best place to get me is just on Twitter. Rick Manilius, all one word, on Twitter and also on IRC.
Same username on IRC and Drupal.org. You're doing
absolutely
the right way.
Just first name, last name, merge. I never have to worry about namespace issues or someone else getting my username.
There you go. And you can always find Drupal Easy at Drupal Easy on Twitter, DrupalEasy.com. And myself, my username everywhere is Ultimike, Ultimike, and that's Drupal.org, Twitter, IRC, and pretty much everywhere else. Then our absent hosts, Andrew M. Riley, Liberator, Ted Bow, and Ted's company, 6 Mile Tech, all available on Twitter. So, Rick, I see you typing in the 5 questions here, but you've already answered the 5 questions.
I know, but in case you want to ask them again, I certainly have to have different answers this time, right?
All right, well, I'm going to ask you the ones that you're filling in here. So tell me about the one person in the Drupal community we should be keeping an eye on.
So it's actually a colleague of mine, Brandon Williams, username Crazy6. He's just been picking up Drupal and Drupal 8 at a phenomenal rate. And I know he's been extremely active at the camps, and he's really trying to get more involved in Drupal core and also in Contrib space. So, you know, he's just really a go-getter, and I think we're going to see more of him.
All right. So he's a developer?
Yes, he's a back-end developer.
So is he new to Drupal or...
He was new to Drupal about a year ago. I mean, he joined our company, and we really, you know, wanted to sort of bring him up to speed to become a back-end dev. And, you know, we started him off in site building and sort of service agreement stuff. And, I mean, he's just really picking up steam and really getting it.
So is he coming from another, like, a PHP background, or is he right out of college? Or
yes.
What's his background?
Strong PHP skills. You know, I'd worked in different CMS and CMS frameworks before, but okay. Just never really, like, full-time Drupal. And,
right.
You know, it was very encouraging to us because I think everyone's, you know, looking for talent from additional sources. And, sure. And, you know, it was just really encouraging to see that it was a much smoother transition than, you know, we feared of like, oh, well, Drupal is so different. And it is. But, you know, people that understand the basics of any other CMS can generally start picking it up pretty quickly.
Exactly. Exactly. And then where would you like to see a future DrupalCon?
While I don't particularly like the city, I think Vegas is... just really great for big conferences and, you know, both, you know, cheap flights, very good venues and so forth and so on. I think, it would be a great place for a venue.
All right. Very good. And, let's see, I'm going to skip your one aspect of Drupal you'd like to learn more about. Pretty much everybody in the community would say Drupal 8 module development.
Absolutely.
But I like your answer to the last one, and I'm trying to rack my brain. I don't think anybody's ever said this before, but if you could add one feature to Drupal core with a snap of your fingers, what would it be?
So the Secure Pages module for Drupal 7 is still not an official release. You know, it's been in beta for basically ever, and it's such a widely used module, but there's basically two core patches that, and this is just more, and I'm not going to complain, but I will say that the patches were already ready to go in Drupal 7 and then Drupal 8 cut, and then the whole procedure of it has to get up to 8 core and then backported.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been one of those things where it's been RBTC for, you know, a long time, but because the test coverage didn't make it up to Drupal 8, you know, pretty much every e-commerce module or any site that we do with e-commerce, these two patches are always applied every time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just one of those things where it's, you know, people have picked it up and almost got it to, you know, RBTC, and but it just never got through. And to have a... You know, Drupal was such a focus on security, to have the Secure Pages module be live in 1.0 would be huge.
Yeah, it seems like this should almost be a core feature of Drupal.
Yeah, I mean, you could make that argument. And I think
8.2, 8.3 maybe, but...
Yeah.
Yeah. It seems like this is something with the emphasis on security, not just from a Drupal standpoint, but, you know, on the internet in general.
Yeah.
It seems like this would be something that would be welcome.
Exactly.
So. All right, fantastic. Well, Rick, thank you as always for joining us and hopefully demystifying PCI compliance for a lot of people.
That's the hope.
That's the hope. If you're listening to the podcast for the first time, you can subscribe at iTunes or Miro or listen to us on Stitcher. You can catch back episodes on drupaleasy.com/podcast. If you want to see what we're tagging during the week about what we might talk about on upcoming episodes, you can follow the Drupal Easy podcast tag on Delicious. And coming up 2 weeks from now, we have Josh Mitchell from the Drupal Association, the CTO. And I'm sure one of the things we'll be talking about is user profiles, but it'd be kind of ridiculous not to talk about the new jobs.drupal.org site as well. And then about a month from now, Matthew Grasmick from Acquia, I believe, is going to come and kind of talk to us about Behat. And I'm going to play the newbie and pretend like I don't know anything about Behat, which I don't. And we're going to try and educate the community a little bit on this apparently really powerful and flexible training framework. I hope that's the right way of saying it. Rick, thank you very much one last time, and we will see everybody on the next Drupal Easy podcast. See ya!